Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
To borrow and slightly modify a phrase, it's a long, long time from June to September, especially when we're going all the way back to June of last year. But it turns out that's how long ago our lives supposedly changed for the better. In case you somehow missed it, that's when the recession officially ended and the recovery, such as it is, began. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here to start a new week on this 20th of September. Okay, so you remember what was going on in your life back in June of last year. Don't know about you, but I wasn't exactly jumping up and down here over how well the economy was doing. But early last summer, 15 months ago, is when the economy officially emerged from the Great Recession. The timing was announced today by a panel of leading economists who, we might point out, have a job deciding such things. So the recession lasted 18 months, which makes it the longest and, it turns out, deepest since the Great Depression. There's nothing like a little dose of reality, though, to curb your enthusiasm. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
The National Bureau of Economic Research uses the broadest measures of economic activity, like gross domestic product, hiring and layoffs, and personal income, to decide when the economy's done shrinking, the recession's over, and we're growing again. But MIT economist Jim Poterba, who chairs the group, says calling the end of a recession and feeling it are not the same.
When you begin a recovery, when you turn the corner, for quite a while, you're quite close to where you were at the bottom. And consequently, the economy may not feel very strong, and that's because it isn't.
To see how much this recovery really feels like one 15 months on, I headed to downtown Portland and caught up with Laurel Baffa. She's an HR recruiter.
We would not consider trying to sell our house during this market over the last couple of years, that sort of thing. And we're just beginning to have a sense that there's hope and there's a future here.
Home prices are still falling. Foreclosures are still mounting. What about spending?
I would say, yes, we're loosening a little, just a smidge at the moment. Nothing dramatic.
And that's a good description of the retail industry, improving a bit, but nothing dramatic. IT consultant Jesse Smith says for him, it still looks like a recession on payday.
The company I'm doing work for right now have had a raise freeze for a number of years, a hiring freeze for years. It seems like at least the jobs part is taking a while to come back.
Lawrence Michel heads up the Economic Policy Institute.
We have to be creating jobs and rapidly lowering unemployment, and people need to see the paychecks of their family members rising.
Instead, unemployment's still near 10%, and it'll probably be well into next year until private employers start hiring enough people to make a dent. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've learned to accept a lot of food that comes to us in, shall we say, an altered state. Seedless watermelon, farm animals bred for extra meat, cows overflowing with milk, and the multi-billion dollar business of genetically modified crops like soybeans and wheat. But this would be something new on the menu. Today, the Food and Drug Administration began its first ever hearings into whether a genetically engineered animal is safe to eat. Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounty Technologies wants to sell a modified variation of salmon. Critics label it frankenfish. Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Aqua Bounty says its genetically altered salmon grow fatter and faster than their unaltered brethren, so fish farmers will be able to produce more salmon at lower cost. Company CEO Ron Stottish says he's hopeful the FDA will see this new superfish as part of the solution to future food supply problems.
With a growing world population and increased demand for a safe and healthy food, and salmon certainly is high protein and it's considered a heart healthy food, the requirement for salmon from aquaculture is increasing.
GMO foods are increasingly widespread. Advocates argue that feeding a world population of 9 billion by mid-century means finding ways to increase food supply. But research so far on the power of genetically altered seeds to increase yields shows mixed results. Gene Halloran at Consumers Union, for one, isn't convinced fatter fish or more bug-resistant crops will solve world hunger.
We think this is a little bit of industry hype, and some international studies have said the same thing.
2 years ago, a major report from the UN and World Bank concluded that genetically engineered food was not the ultimate solution to world hunger and poverty. The report said the unequal distribution of food and conflict over dwindling resources were the real challenges. But right now, critics of this new modified salmon are focusing on issues closer to American consumers, like whether the fish will cause allergies or alter other fish populations if it escapes. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The new TV season kicks off tonight with some very glossy new shows. Just wait a commercial minute, though. Aren't audiences shrinking along with ad dollars? In spite of, or perhaps because of that, the networks are spending big on their lineups. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
From NBC's mysterious new drama, The Event, to CBS's revival of Hawaii Five-0, to the tabloid-tacular new season of Dancing with the Stars featuring Bristol Palin and Jersey Shore's The Situation, this season's new lineup is impressive and expensive, says Bill Carroll with Katz Television Group.
The shows are really bringing the competitive level to a new high.
Networks are losing audience to cable channels, mobile devices, and the internet. Kat says this season is a reminder that there's still big money in TV and that nothing brings in the numbers the networks do.
Even if viewers watch on their TiVo or their iPad, it starts on broadcast television.
This is the last gasp of network television.
That's Porter Bibb with MediaTek Capital Partners.
The networks are spending unconscionably in an attempt to try to stave off the continuing erosion of network audiences.
Bibb says consumers want to watch shows when they have time, on their DVRs or online via Hulu or Netflix. And Apple and Google are both poised to unveil their TV devices. Bibb says throwing money at special effects, all-star casts, and marketing campaigns is all the networks have got right now.
That's what you do if you're running a business and you haven't got an answer to the new environment.
Still, Bibb says the expensive new lineups could pay off. Bibb agrees high-quality scripted shows are exactly what people will pay to watch on their DVRs, iPads, and phones. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Give traders a little encouragement in these times, even if it is old recession news, and Wall Street will take a mile. The details when we do the numbers. As we noted, the Great Recession ended in June of last year, according to the economists who decide such things. We also pointed out that doesn't take into account still high unemployment. And I'm sure you've heard that other U word weighing on the economy, uncertainty, which got commentator Justin Fox thinking about what that really means.
Business leaders have been complaining that uncertainty is keeping them from investing and the economy from growing. Many lay the blame on Washington. Companies don't know what next year's tax rates will be, they say, or how much the new health care regime is going to cost them. So they're paralyzed. I'm not going to deny that there's uncertainty emanating from our nation's capital. It's partly because we have this thing called a representative democracy, which causes economic policy to veer this way or that every few years. This is one reason why business types love China. Fewer course changes. Of course, the frequent course changes of a democracy probably make wrenching, revolutionary changes less likely. Just look at China over the past century. What's more, I'm dubious of the argument that politicians are the main source of today's economic uncertainty. There are wrenching, revolutionary changes afoot in the global economy that affect business far more profoundly than anything Washington can come up with, at least on short notice. To name a few, we have a financial system that's prone to crisis. The rise of new technologies and the rise of new economic powers like China, India, and Brazil are upending business models right and left. It's also possible that global warming will soon cause sudden climate shifts that bring massive economic change and turmoil. Now that's uncertainty. And here's the thing. In the business world, uncertainty spells opportunity. It's when almost everybody agrees on what the future will look like that investors and entrepreneurs do the stupidest things and blow the most money. Just think of the internet stock bubble or the real estate boom. Putting money into a project right now may seem scary and dangerous, but chances are that it's a lot less dangerous than investing 3 or 4 years ago. So let's stop complaining about all the uncertainty, people. Let's start looking for ways to make money off it.
Justin Fox is editor-director of the Harvard Business Review. We'd love to review your comments. Drop us a line at marketplace.org. The Brits are bracing for big cuts in public spending. Britain's new coalition government plans to announce its new austerity plans next month. Welfare and defense are conspicuous big-ticket targets, but British conservationists fear a less obvious casualty. Will the country's cherished hedgerows get chopped? Christopher Wirth has the story.
If you're wondering what hedgerows are, they're the long rows of wild shrubs and small trees that line many of England's country roads and fields, the kind of thing you might come across in postcards depicting traditional English scenes and the lyrics of English rock band Led Zeppelin. But here in the UK, people are becoming alarmed. Emma Merrington is with the Campaign to Protect Rural England. She says over the past decade or so, the country has lost over 16,000 miles of hedgerows, and those that remain aren't always kept in good condition.
They're part of our heritage, they're part of the landscape, and it would be quite a different countryside if we didn't have them.
That thought sends shivers up the spines of rural Brits. The hedgerow at the edge of this field in Oxfordshire dates from around the 10th century. Saxons built hedgerows to pen in livestock and divide farmland for horses and plows. After the Second World War, that all changed. The government gave farmers grants to rip out their hedgerows and to grow more food through large-scale mechanized farming.
A field system that's designed for a man with a horse plow isn't going to work for a huge John Deere tractor and a combine harvester.
Jeff Radley is with Natural England, a government conservation body that now spends about $100 million paying farmers to replant hedgerows and to take care of those that are left. He says hedgerows are still good for things like preventing soil erosion, and because they're what everyone expects to see when they visit the English countryside, they're also good for tourism.
That's why the taxpayer supports hedgerow conservation, because they produce all this range of benefits for wider society.
But with budget cuts looming, no one's sure how much longer that government support can last.
So I've cleared my way into the hedge.
Working on this hedgerow is Nigel Adams of the National Hedgelaying Society. Its members include Prince Charles, and its mission is to keep alive many of the age-old pruning techniques that have kept hedgerows going for centuries.
I'm using a billhook, which is an old, traditional, ancient cutting tool, double-sided cutting tool.
It looks a lot like the kind of weapon an ancient Saxon might have carried. Adams carefully cuts into the base of the hedge and then lays it over to generate new growth. He says without the money to pay for this kind of loving care, England's hedgerows could become a thing of the past.
In the next 30 years, I fear if we look at the same landscape, there will be no hedges there whatsoever because they're just faded out.
And that could be bad news for England's wildlife as well.
This hedge is ideal for linnets, yellowhammers, white throats.
Richard Winspear of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds peers at a group of swallows through a pair of binoculars. It's estimated around 130 species depend on hedgerows like this for their survival.
We're very concerned about the potential for the budget cuts to restrict the ability of farmers to get funding to manage their land better for wildlife. In fact, it's probably the biggest issue we face in the next few months.
In the meantime, conservationists are looking for new ways to entice farmers to take care of hedgerows as government support is cut. You could even say they're hedging their bets. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Looks like just about every window is broken. It's boarded up.
Yeah, it's a nightmare for the person who lives next door.
When foreclosure comes to town, can lenders be held responsible? But first, let's do the numbers. Celebration. The Dow Jones Industrial Average bounced up 145 points. That's 1.3% to finish at 10,753. The NASDAQ clicked up 40 points, 1.75% to close at 2355. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, 1.5% to end the day at 1142. Investors gained confidence the U.S. economy wouldn't veer into a double-dip recession, and that built confidence in home construction. Lennar erected an 8% gain. Beazer Homes rose 6%. Pulte Group nailed a 5% rise. Toll Brothers was up 3.25%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.70%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at Vanguard.com/public radio. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for August. The Federal Reserve meets to discuss interest rates and the economy. And the Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on welfare reform, focusing on women and poverty. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ristall. There was a clarification today of some rather candid comments from former Secretary of State Colin Powell. He does not, he says, hire illegal immigrants. But what he meant yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press is that many contractors in his neighborhood may well be using undocumented workers.
They're all over my house doing things whenever I call for repairs, and I'm sure you've seen them at your house. We've got to find a way to bring these people out of the darkness and give them some kind of status.
Powell wants Republicans to support a bill called the DREAM Act. It would open citizenship to young immigrants who attend 2 years of college or join the military. Joining us now to explore Mr. Powell's moment of candor is Dowell Myers. He's a professor of demography at the University of Southern California. Welcome, sir.
I'm pleased to be here.
Today, in clarifying his statement, Mr. Powell said there are 11 million illegal immigrants in this country, and most are working somewhere in our economy. What's your take on that? Is he in the ballpark on this underground economy of immigrants?
Well, the 11 million figure is one everybody seems to subscribe to it, although you have to know that these people are undocumented, so we don't really have hard numbers on them.
Where is the intersection of this underground economy and the mainstream economy in America?
Well, they're disproportionately very low-skilled workers with very low education, and they're coming in to work jobs that we don't really provide visas for. We don't really like to admit that we have these low-skilled service workers that we need. The problem in America is we've educated everybody so much here that all of our native-born are above that skill level, and yet we have more and more demands for basic service workers.
And former Secretary Powell put a personal spin on this, that it seems many in this debate don't talk about, that they benefit quite directly and personally from the work that these people do. What about that on an individual basis? How are Americans interacting with immigrants?
Well, he's speaking like an urbanite and somebody who lives in an area that has lots of immigrants. For people in the middle of the U.S., they don't have as much exposure, and the undocumented workers or unauthorized workers are more often working in poultry processing plants or in some industrial capacity. They're not working in people's homes. But along the coast in California and all along the eastern seaboard, it's very common to have the yard maintenance workers, the nannies, all kinds of domestic help, people who may or may not have legal papers.
So many Americans we know are interacting with these people who Mr. Powell complained are otherwise kept in the darkness and he said need to be given some kind of status. Why do you think there's such a disconnect between the political debate that casts this in a kind of abstract way and the very real status they play in our daily lives?
Well, some of the Gallup poll data shows that people who respond to questions about immigrants who live in the middle of the country where there aren't very many immigrants have much different answers than those who respond from areas where they do have immigrants living near them. For example, there's a question that they ask, I think it goes roughly, do immigrants come here to gain welfare or do they come here to work? And the people who think that they come here to gain welfare live in places where there aren't very many immigrants. So they don't know how hardworking these people are.
And yet beyond this personal experience that Mr. Powell talked about, he seems to be dialing back his statement today. Why do you think that that political disconnect still exists even here?
Well, I think that he was speaking from personal experience, but there's an organized political response that is different from personal. It's more strategic, and he may have heard from other people who suggested that his personal remarks were out of line with the party line.
Dal Myers is a professor of urban planning and demography at USC. Thanks for letting us tap some of your scholarship on this subject.
It's my pleasure.
Here we are, 3 years into the housing crisis. The recession it sparked is already deemed to be over, but it seems we still haven't really settled on a culprit. Was it homeowners who bought more house than they could afford? Or was it predatory lenders who didn't care what happened to the mortgage after they got their fees? Today, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson is wrapping up our series on how the Heartland is coping. His final installment is a look at the fight over foreclosures in the land of the Delta Blues.
Call it the Memphis Misery Tour. I'm in a car with a lawyer who's representing Memphis and surrounding Shelby County in a lawsuit against Wells Fargo. We're driving through Orange Mound, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city.
This neighborhood is just filled with foreclosures.
Oh, absolutely. It's, about a third.
Attorney Steve Barlow says many of the former owners of these homes were doing just fine until lenders came along and convinced them to refinance or take on a second mortgage. An adjustable rate loan that meant more cash in their pockets right away in exchange for a sky-high mortgage rate later. What's left for all to see is foreclosure after foreclosure.
It looks like just about every window is broken. It's boarded up. The grass is overgrown. There are weeds coming out the side. It's next to an empty lot.
Yeah, it's a nightmare for the person who lives next door.
Although next door is also boarded up.
Right.
You can imagine what all these abandoned homes mean for the people who still live here.
It's so much. What can we do? Look at all these houses.
Kim Watkins is watching her two small kids in front of her home. She's living right in between two empty houses. She says squatters have taken over the neighborhood.
They got sheets up to some of them. They come in, do all kind of illegal things. That this house just got broken in, the door kicked in. And you're afraid to tell them, leave, you know. They shoot up your houses, all kind of thing. We got kids here, so it's just like jail in your own home, if you ask me.
The lawsuit the city filed against Wells Fargo claims the bank violated the Fair Housing Act by targeting minority neighborhoods and deceptively steered borrowers toward high-cost subprime loans. It says between 2004 and 2008, more than half of Wells Fargo loans to black borrowers were subprime. That's three times the rate for white borrowers. What's more, the rate of foreclosure in black neighborhoods has been seven times higher than in white neighborhoods. Bring that up with the people at Wells Fargo, and you'll get this response.
We do not make lending decisions based on race. We make it based on credit, on amount of debt outstanding, on other factors like down payment.
Brad Blackwell is the national sales manager for Wells Fargo. He says the city is unfairly focusing on his company. He says blighted neighborhoods existed long before any of these loans were made, and that foreclosures soared because of the recession in general, not because of Wells Fargo's subprime loans.
What's happened in Memphis and in many other municipalities, particularly big urban centers, is that many areas have been very hard hit by the economy. And some of these areas, like downtown Memphis, have been harder hit And consequently, you have higher foreclosure rates in those neighborhoods.
And he says lenders have no more interest in a foreclosure than homeowners do. I brought that argument up with Steve Barlow, the lawyer representing the city.
But why would the original lender want to do that? They have no interest in having a foreclosed home, do they?
The original lender makes their money in fees at the closing table, then packages the loan, sells it.
But proving that Wells Fargo acted illegally and caused broader damage to Memphis won't be easy. Similar cases against Wells Fargo and other lenders have been dismissed in Cleveland, Birmingham, and Baltimore. And unless this lawsuit progresses to the next phase, the city's lawyers won't have access to the loan documents they'll need to show the scope of what they call Wells Fargo's predatory lending. Mayor A.C. Wharton can see the scope of the housing crisis from his seventh-floor office in City Hall. He says all the foreclosures have brought financial harm to the city, a spike in crime, and a big loss in property tax revenue.
In the South, particularly in this city, we live on property taxes. Roughly 60% of the revenue, 62% almost, comes from property taxes. We don't have diverse sources of income as other jurisdictions do.
Whatever happens with the lawsuit, Mayor Wharton will have to deal with a shrinking base of homeowners. Between 2005 and 2008, the city lost 7,000 of them, two-thirds of whom left because of foreclosure. In Memphis, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, 2 weeks from now, our long national bailout is officially over. The door will be closing on new investments by the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program. But you know what they say, whenever one door closes, another door of opportunity opens. In this case, an expected wave of TARP fraud litigation. As the program winds down, the office in charge of TARP oversight is hiring new staff and opening 4 regional offices. They say they'll be focusing on whether banks may have misrepresented their financial condition to qualify for bailout funds. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 145 points. That's 1.3%. The Nasdaq clicked up 40 points, 1.75%. And the S&P 500 added 17 points, 1.5%. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, Jolie Myers, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, how a lack of playtime has affected tomorrow's leaders.
They're getting students turning up, brilliant students, you know, but they have no imagination. They're just completely crammed full of information.
Musician and author Dave Stewart on creativity and business. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.